Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Oh, Miles here.
Your Owlpost for the week is freshly delivered, and I am just one of the hosts here, Matthew Rushing, and with me, as she is every single week, the sweatered Drea Kaufman.
Hello.
Hello, hello. You must either, the weather there is cooler, or the air conditioning is up.
The air conditioning's up. I mean, I think it's getting a little cooler outside, and the air conditioning's up, but... I also have a weirdly striped shirt on today that on my work computer.
Ooh, a weirdly striped shirt.
It, like, I don't know what it did. It, like, it, you know, when you take a picture of a screen mm-hmm. and it has all those, like, weird blurry lines. Yeah, yep. My shirt was like that on web calls today. And it got to the point where, like, it was kind of hurting my eyes and I didn't want to go change.
You were freaking out other people on the call, too.
I don't know. Maybe, but I didn't want to go change, so I just put a sweater over it because I always have a sweater handy because it's weird, but Arizonans always know you have a sweater handy.
Well, so, I mean, you got to turn the air conditioner down to like 68, so.
When you could go out, but when you go out to eat, they try so hard to keep everything really cool that it overcompensates mm-hmm. this time yep. of year when it's yep. not as hot. So it's like 55 degrees inside the restaurant and 90 degrees outside. And so you have to dress for both. So like we have a very unique definition of layers, dressing in layers here. But yeah, that you always have some sort of sweater in your car or handy or whatever. So yeah, it makes movies great though, because you can kind of like bundle up and like really get yeah. comfy and snuggy while you watch a
can we
movie
not talk
the
about
theater.
That? That's a sore subject for me. So.
I know you're still so upset, but you made it yeah. to one.
I did. Yeah. I'd gone to see Tenet. I had to drive an hour, but it was totally worth it. So, anyway, people are not here to hear about Tenet. They can do that over in the 602 Club. But we want to say thank you for joining us before we dive into Chapter 14, The Thief. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, any of those places. If you happen to be on Apple Podcasts, please give us a star rating review. Let people know what you think of the show, and we'll read that out on the show as well. And then, of course, you can find us on Twitter, at JoinNerdParty. We're on Facebook at Facebook.com/TheNerdParty. There's TheNerdParty.com. You can go to the contact section. You can send Dre and I an email, and you can find us on Instagram, too, at TheNerdParty. So, Dre, this is a very quick chapter, honestly, but there is a lot that happens in it. And
well, there's a lot that gets set up to happen in
that,
it
this
right
is true.
like not an actual lot happens here, we just learn a lot here,
right? That's true. But there is, I mean, it is interesting because this is going to set up a lot of what's going to happen in this part of the book from now
yes.
on, you know. Yes. And part of that is where they land, that they have landed in some woods as Harry's waking up and he realizes they're not at Grimmauld Place anymore. And he sees that Hermione and Ron are kind of off from him. And it turns out Ron has been splinched. And it's just this really horrible scene. He's bleeding and Hermione's like holding his head, and she's, you know, once Harry's awake, she's like, Harry, you know, grab the dittany that's in my bag. And this was one of the things that I thought was really interesting. You know, throughout the series, Harry kind of reverts, I think, to being just a muggle, and immediately, like, he would have been like sifting through the bag normally, but Harry immediately remembers he doesn't have to rummage through the bag. He just accios it immediately. And I was like, Harry's learning. That's so great.
Well, he kind of does. Like, he kind of does. Because he does reach in and they do describe, he feels some objects. And he very quickly realizes it's like a lost cause to try to search that way. And then he reverts to being a wizard, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I think that that's so true. The things that we learn are so incredible. The things that we grow up with, the things that become us and define us are so hard to unlearn, right? Like remembering to use magic first is not his first instinct, which it becomes, because later in the chapter, he has to look for the tent in the bag and he's like, oh yeah, no, there's no reason to bother. I'm going to just, you know, accio it. But yeah, I mean, he learns very quickly. And this is a part, actually, it's so small and almost insignificant, but they don't do a great job in the movie of depicting Harry's sort of panic in the moment. He seems very capable and I don't know how to describe it. Like, he's very calm and organized and methodical in what he's doing in the movie. And in the book, he's very frantic, very worried, doesn't really know, is scatterbrained, very instinctual, right? And I appreciate it so much more. In the book, his best friend is like bleeding. He doesn't know what happened or where they are, or why they are, right? There's so much going on. I think the book does a good job of showing the confusion and the sort of fury of what's happening over the movie.
Yeah, small, no, I think you're right. I mean, both of them are in this place, right? For Hermione, Ron is somebody who she is very close to now. You know, like, close to, like, you know, they're on that line of, like,
with him. Yeah,
dating. And so, and we even, yeah.
They're dating us.
Right, exactly. Because we get a moment in a minute where Harry almost feels like he's interrupted them. Because it's so intimate between them, right?
He's
you know,
crusher.
Yeah. But I do. I love that. I love that this feels frantic. It feels awful. You know, because it is. You know, Ron is bleeding badly, and without this medicine, he is gonna die. And so, luckily, the Dittany is able to save him and to help him. And Hermione even mentions there are probably other spells that she could do. But she's not a healer, basically. She's not good enough, and she doesn't want to make it worse. And so I appreciate that, you know, she's done all she can. And for Hermione to be able to be like, to not try something, it lets you realize just how much this is affecting her, you know, with because this is Ron. Like, she's not even willing to take the chance because of how much Ron means to her. And Harry, you know, like, and so I just like, you really see, I think, like you said, this does such a better job than the movie, where you really are getting a picture of just how much this is impacting both of them in this moment.
Well, it also really spells the fact of, like, they don't have other resources, right? Like, if she screws up, there's no one to help. There's no one to solve. There's nowhere to go. So she knows whatever she does can only happen within the confines of what they are, where they are, what they have. So on top of that, I think it also sorts to show a little of, like, the isolation that they're in, right?
Yes.
Like, this is like sort of the desperate times that they're in, that good enough is going to have to be good enough. And she just describes the splinching. I do appreciate she calls out that the word is kind of funny, and that Harry always mm-hmm. kind of thought it was funny, and then he saw it happen, and it's actually horrifying, and it's really not all that funny. because I agree. I always kind of thought the word was a little funny. But it reminds me of, like, when you fold something in half and then you cut the half and it, like, comes apart as this bit. Yeah. I totally envision what splinching looks like. Her word was perfect. I can envision what happens when you get splinched. But yeah, it's not great. And, you know, I do love, too, that here Ron is, like, half Ron, half Cattermole during this whole thing.
Yeah.
So they're also having a hard time telling if he's, like, actually having blood loss or if he's just still half Cattermole, right? Like, he's really pale and gray, but maybe that's because he's still half of this other person. So the whole thing just, you know, they get him, they Accio something else out of the bag, and it turns out it's the tent from the Quidditch World Cup. And Harry recognizes it because of the cat smell, which is just horrifying. If anyone's ever smelled, that's just not mm-hmm. what you
it
want.
It is. It is. No.
It's just not what you want. And, you know, they kind of start to set up shop there, and they slowly ease Ron into the bed and kind of, you know, regroup from there. And we start to kind of put together the pieces of what's just happened.
Yeah, because one of the things we get is Harry and Hermione talking about why they didn't go back to Grimmauld Place and why they aren't there. And Hermione tells the story of why she took them here. It's because Yaxley had grabbed onto her, and as they were apparating Grimmauld Place, she could not get rid of him. And they were inside the zone where he could see the door. And because they're secret keepers, after Dumbledore's death, that means that they could now enter Grimmauld Place. Yaxley would know, he would be able to see it. And so they could never go back there again. So there's really this sense of loss for them that there was this place that they, even though like Harry even thinks about it in his head, he's like, yeah, it was dark and dingy, but like Creature was so much happier and it kind of was feeling like home a little bit. And Hermione is apologizing to Harry too. And Harry's like, no, this is my fault. And he takes out the eye that he stole from her door, Umbridge's door. And he's like, this is my fault. I couldn't leave this. And I'm pretty sure that when they saw that this was missing, that's why they were after us. And so, you know, it's one of those things. Like, Harry did what he thought was right because he couldn't leave a piece of his friend there. But it cost them, you know, going back to Grimmauld Place. And so, yeah.
So this whole scene really plays into a Dumbledore quote from several books ago where he says that doing what's right isn't always, like, doing what's easy is not always what's right, right? So taking the eyeball out of the door and sort of preserving Mad-Eye Moody and not, it's mutilating it, right? Like, sorry, small child. Sorry, six-year-old who reads this at night. I hope this does not haunt her dreams. But, you know, like, this is a mutilation of this body. And so he did the right thing and wants to respect and honor and knows that Mad-Eye would never want to be associated with Umbridge's door. And so he did the right thing, even though it wasn't easy, right? Both escaping and there was sacrifice associated with it. And I think that's the true meaning of that statement, right? That it was the right thing to do. And there is a moral justification there, but there's also a sacrifice that goes along with that, which is what makes it so difficult for people to always choose the right thing.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. And I think in many ways, you know, it reminds us that, you know, what is right is not usually easy.
Right.
So
and sometimes you have to do it and just know that there's, you know, like this, the fulfillment comes from within, right? Like there is a personal, he did this as a personal feeling. He knew that this was the right thing to do. And he didn't know the consequences of it, but you know, he can't talk about, oh, well, I shouldn't have done that. That was never even stated here, right?
Sure.
He's like, no, I did it. This is what I did. Right.
Yeah.
There was never a, well, maybe I shouldn't have taken the eye or we wouldn't have gotten caught. No, just that was the right, like there was no debate as to whether that was what they should have done or not. And I appreciate that because that is hard, especially in today's day and age where that would be questioned, right? Like, oh, well, maybe if you hadn't taken the eye, it would have been that much easier. Well, okay, but I'm leaving a poor friend in a place that he shouldn't be and no one should be treated that way. But you know, and then he kind of goes on to have sort of a personal grief and has to kind of push it out of his mind when he starts to think about Creature. So you mentioned Creature was happier. He also tries very hard not to think too hard about the fact that he won't be able to go back and have dinner with Creature like Creature's expecting. And, you know, that he doesn't know what's going to happen to the house elf. Can he apparate away? Can he escape? Will he tell on them? You know, he has no idea. But he tries really hard not to think about it because it doesn't do him any good at this point.
Right, right. Absolutely, and they have a lot to think about. I mean, Hermione starts setting up protection charms around the tent. Harry's setting up the tent. They get Ron into, you know, the tent to help him lay down. And it was really interesting because they have this moment where they're going to have a conversation about things, and Hermione starts to say Voldemort's name, and Ron just has a fit. He's like, do not say that name. And they start to be like, but Dumbledore said, and Harry's like, look, it obviously didn't do Dumbledore any good. And so can we just say, you know who, can we just show him some respect? And Harry's about to kind of get into it with Ron, and Hermione gives him a look, and he just drops it. But it is really interesting because, you know, this is something that is going to get brought up actually a few times in this chapter of like, can we just not say that name? And I think, you know, this is one of those places where Ron and Hermione and Harry are different in the sense that Ron grew up in the wizarding world. And so he grows up with those prejudices. He grows up with those idiosyncrasies, whereas Harry and Hermione did not. And this is one of those places where they didn't grow up with this fear or understanding of this character named Voldemort in the same way that Ron probably did in his household, since his parents were in the Order, and he probably did hear some stories about what things were like back then that Harry and Hermione would never have known until, you know, a few years ago, right? And so I think it's a much different understanding of the world, and it kind of helps us be reminded that most people in the Wizarding world think like Ron does.
Well, and I also think when you think about the characters and what they bring to the table is strengths and sort of, we talked a little bit about like your natural impulse, right? Harry and Hermione and Ron all have very different strengths and impulses, which is why they make such a great team, right? Because they kind of cover each other's gaps and together make a very, very, very strong trio, which is why whenever they're together, you know, we're all doomed for good reasons. But Ron has always really acted from a gut instinct, instinctual perspective, right? Like, he has good instincts for things, except for women. And so he has always reacted sort of a gut reaction to things, right? He'll always ask that question. That's just who he is. So for me, listening to this too, he's having sort of a gut reaction to the name, both based on what you've said about his history with it. But I also think he just knows it's more significant than we know, but he doesn't know how to explain it yet, right? Harry and the wand. He doesn't know how to explain it. He knows something to be true, something to be right. And so, you know, he's just finally to the point where I think he's just starting to express it more. Like, just trust me, guys. My instinct says don't do this. I just need you to do this for me. I don't care if you can rationalize it your way. I'm asking you, call him he who shall be named, or he who shall not be named. So, you know, I also think we have to think about it from that perspective too, right? Like, Ron is having a strong reaction to this, and Harry, as his best friend, kind of knows that he's not going to ask if it's not sort of important to him.
Yeah.
So, well, it's a combination of things, I think.
On that same note, I think you're absolutely right, because this is when Ron's like, do you think the Cattermoles were able to escape? And he's really having this kind of emotional connection with them and worried about their well-being. And this is that moment where Hermione's looking at him as if, like, she had just kissed him. Like, it's that intimate. And Harry feels kind of uncomfortable in this moment in some ways that he's in the middle of this. Because I think Hermione is really seeing Ron's heart, right? And Ron is showing that to us as well. And that he really does care about other people. And it reminds you, too, of the same feeling that he must be feeling about his own family and the danger that they're in. And so I think Ron really, Ron kind of shines in this chapter in some ways. Even though he's also having a very difficult time because he's healing. And, you know, they're all dealing with this Horcrux, which Hermione, you know, pulls it out of her robes, and they realize this Horcrux is, one, they don't know how to destroy it, and two, the thing kind of seems to be alive, which is super creepy. And it's something that, as Harry's on guard duty, you know, they don't have a lot of food, because that's the one thing Hermione forgot to do, was to pack any food.
Well, it's not that she forgot to do it. It's that she didn't anticipate the need
based
on the circumstances.
That was the one thing she did not anticipate.
Like, yes, because her thoughts were they were going to go back to Grimmauld Place.
Right.
And so it's not that she forgot it. She just didn't think they were going to need it. So why put the effort and energy towards it?
Absolutely.
Right? Yeah, for sure. And I do love, too, this whole, you were talking about Ron kind of having his shining moments in this chapter. I think it also speaks a lot to being very authentic to yourself, right? Like, he's in a lot of pain. He doesn't really have a tolerance to be very PC or think about others' feelings. So what we're seeing here is a very true and authentic version of Ron as well. And I think that, you know, while he's in this pain and recovering, that his authentic self truly cares about these people he knows nothing about. I think that just lends itself even more so to how kind his heart really is. And, you know, that too is part of his upbringing, because his parents would care the same way. So, you know, I think it's such a great opportunity to say, like, those times that we're really stressed and broken down are often the glimpses into who we really are. And we should really, you know, take stock in that. And I think this is a good chapter to do that for Ron, to look at him as him, right? He's purely him in pain and all. So.
Well, and I think it is really interesting, too, because as Harry is sitting at guard duty, he has this locket against his neck that doesn't seem to even take any of his body heat. It still feels like icy cold against him, and he feels this kind of like almost like heartbeat in it. He's worried about the Horcruxes. He's worried about finding the rest of them. He's worried about destroying them. He's kind of spiraling, and in that moment, he begins to have his scar hurt, and he begins to see that Voldemort has found Grigorovich and is interrogating him about something that apparently he used to have, but he does not have anymore. And so Voldemort searches his mind and finds this memory of Grigorovich in his workshop, making his way through his workshop and seeing a blonde-haired boy grab something and then hop out the window. And
I thought this was awesome that not only does he get to read Voldemort's mind, he gets to read Voldemort's mind reading somebody else's mind, which is totally not depicted in the movie very well, but it's amazing.
Well, and it's really interesting because then it's this thief that who he's after. And Grigorovich does not know who the thief was. And so Voldemort kills him. And that's the moment where Harry gets woken up by Hermione, and Hermione's really mad at him for, you know, not learning occlumency. And she's like, you know what? If you can't, stop falling asleep, I'm going to finish this watch. And Harry's going to, like, argue with her, but she's like, Hermione's just not in the mood. And so Harry takes himself to bed, and Ron is the one who's like, what did he show you? And they together talk about what it is that Grigorovich wants, and they don't know what it is, but Ron has an interesting theory. He's like, what if he wants to make another Horcrux? And Harry's like, I don't know. I mean, it could be that. I don't think it is, but wouldn't it be dangerous for him to push it past the limit he's already at? Like, Hermione mentioned that she believes that his soul is already at the limit with 7. And so, but Harry thinks he knows what this is. He thinks that whatever it is that Voldemort is after, Grigorovich used to have, and it's not wand lore, but it must be something that he thinks is going to help him with the problem of the cores of their wands. So it's just really fascinating because there's a, like, you know, he also, this, and the most interesting thing is that Harry's like, I've seen that blonde-haired boy before. Where was it? And he can't remember.
I hate that. I super hate that.
It's the worst. Like, and when you can't just look him up on IMDb, you know, it's so frustrating.
He just can't Wikipedia it or download the picture from his mind to his wizarding computer. There's so much here, and Ron really stepping. So first of all, I can totally relate to Hermione, and I'm just picturing her shooting him this like mom look, this like, don't mess with me, do what I say, go to your room look. But the conversation between Ron and Harry, I think it's also a little bit of a trade-off, right? Like, Harry let go of the whole Voldemort versus he who shall not be named thing. And so I think this is Ron doing the same for him, right? Like, sure, he doesn't quite believe Harry yet. Like, he's sort of, you know, just, I don't know. He's not on board with the theory yet, But he knows that Harry wants to talk it through and that he knows him well enough to know he needs to verbally process in order for this to work for him, and that he's probably dying to say something at this point because there's sort of this pregnant pause right. between them. And so I feel like it's just, again, such a kind thing to do. He's probably exhausted, could have easily just feigned being asleep. But instead, you know, he kind of extends the arm and says, like, hey, man, this is, you want to talk about it. And so it's another time where Ron kind of shows that innate kindness and selflessness to support his friend, which is super, should be super simple. But I mean, I've been exhausted and not want to talk to my husband at bedtime, and wasn't even splinched. So,
right.
You know, I don't have an excuse, but, I think it's a nice moment. And I think that as we continue to see these bonds between the characters, it makes it all the more important for the story ahead as to how things are going to shift and how the dynamics are going to change. Not to spoil anything, guys. Things are going to change.
Yeah. Well, and I do think that Ron is interested, too. You know, I think he, unlike Hermione, Ron doesn't quite see things the same way Hermione does here, where he thinks that Harry shouldn't be seeing this stuff at all. And I think he's a little bit more on Harry's wavelength as to how this could be utilized. And honestly, you know, when you think about it logically, it's really kind of the only connection that they have right now to anything about what's going on. And so it kind of makes sense to try and utilize all the information you can in any way possible, because as Harry was thinking to himself earlier, like, he doesn't know where these other Horcruxes are. He doesn't know how to destroy them. And they have no connection with the outside world, really. So it's like, this is really their only lead to some things happening. And it seems like to try and shut that off would be irresponsible of them.
Well, and Ron, while kind of steeped in institutional bias and some of those other classist things we've talked about in former chapters, he also is one of the most open-minded characters, right?
He takes
a lot of convincing to come along sometimes in those thought processes. But I mean, reprogramming yourself to unlearn something you've known to be true your whole life is a challenge. And so the fact that he can do that and still be open-minded enough to have these conversations and be engaged and say, okay, I'm going to reject all things that make sense, and I'm going to listen to what you say because there's probably some truth and reality in there, and I can help you work through it, is a big step, right? And it shows how open-minded he is. So to your point, he wants to know because he's curious. And he thinks there might be something real there, where Hermione has completely rejected this theory, as she's done with several of, you know, Harry's theories over the books in the years. And so I think to your point, yeah, he totally is. He's not sold yet, but he's also not unsold. Like,
right, exactly.
He hasn't been convinced fully enough to, like, defend it, but he wants to know, and he wants to continue to go on the journey. He's just not willing to stand up and argue for the theory yet.
Right. Well,
he's not
right,
fully
exactly.
on board.
Well, and there's a point where it's like, you know, earlier where Hermione knew to give Harry the look to drop it with Voldemort's name. You know, I think Ron also knows times to when it's best to just have a conversation between him and Harry because Hermione's not in the mood, you know. And obviously Hermione's not in the mood right now. So, but I think that him and Harry do believe at this point that this is kind of an important conversation to have. And so and it's going to be interesting because this really changes a lot of things in the book. And it changes a lot of things about their journey. They have one Horcrux, but they have a lot of problems right now. And so to see how they move through this is going to be really interesting. And I'm excited.
We've got everything from how do you destroy a Horcrux to what's for my next meals, right?
What's for dinner?
What's for dinner? How do I destroy an evil artifact that I have no information on? It's the whole gambit here. We got the whole spectrum going for us, or I guess against us. So this is that opportunity to let every little thing slide and really focus on what's important here. So we'll see if they can do that.
Yeah.
I got bets. I got bets
some
going.
Bets too.
If you want odds, let me know.
Well, if people want to catch up with you before we come back for the next chapter, chapter 14, The Goblin's Revenge, where can people find you, Drea?
If you want the odds on how many Skittles to M&Ms based on whether these kids can prioritize and let the little things go, you can find me on Twitter at PCFCheck or on Instagram at Drea Kaufman, and it's C-O-F-F-M-A-N.
And you can find me on Twitter, Instagram, Letterboxd, Vero under the name MattRushing02. You can also find the 602 Club at the 602 Club on Twitter, which is the show I do over on TFM, which is our geek show, a local geek show, talking about all things geeky outside of Star Trek. I'm also over on TFM doing Literary Treks with Chris Jones, talking about the books and comics of Star Trek, as well as Deep Space Nine with him on a show called The Orb. And then here on this network, the Nerd Party, you can find me doing Arrested Negotiations with John Mills, as each and every week we're talking about a fun topic in Star Wars. In fact, we are doing commentaries for all the episodes of The Mandalorian before season 2 comes out, so check that out. But you know what? Thank you so much for checking your outpost.
Mischief managed.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.